From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Thursday, May 10th. I'm Marco Werman. Twin suicide bombings in Damascus killed dozens of people. Our reporter there says the attacks underscore the obstacles to peace in Syria.
There is a huge challenge in trying to establish a ceasefire. I mean, there's supposed to be one in place, but it's being broken every single day.
And later, blue clay at the Madrid Tennis Open. This photographer loves the new surface.
It's nice and you can see the ball better. The contrast is fantastic.
But the players, not so much.
PRI's The World is made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, presenting the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's no peace in Syria. That much is clear after two powerful explosions today in Damascus. Syrian officials said they were twin suicide bombings that killed at least 55 people and injured more than 300. It was the deadliest bomb attack in Damascus since the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad started in March last year. While the two sides trade blame for the continuing violence, the United Nations-backed ceasefire in Syria appears in danger of falling apart. But Ahmed Fawzi, spokesman for UN envoy Kofi Annan, told the BBC that the ceasefire is still viable.
What happened today is an abhorrent act. We have all condemned it. Mr. Annan himself has condemned it in the strongest possible terms. These actions escalate tensions, and raising the levels of violence can only be counterproductive to the interests of all the parties in Syria. Those who proclaim that the Annan plan has failed, have they come up with a viable alternative?
Well, so far the answer to that question is no. The World's Laura Lynch is in the Syrian capital, and she visited the site of the bombing today.
It is necessary but grim work. Emergency crews clear up the debris that's scattered across the roadway. With each scrape across the charred pavement, the shovels pick up burnt metal, bits of clothing, and even human flesh. Nearby, the shells of what used to be more than 20 cars and buses show just how powerful these bombs were. So too do the two craters, each several feet deep. The bombs hit just outside a huge military intelligence building, ripping off its facade. But the blast shattered windows and lives many yards away. Men at this small garage are trying to pull away metal sheeting that landed in front of the entrance. The owner sits inside, staring in disbelief at the scene around him. It sounded more like an earthquake than an explosion, he says, before introducing me to his brother, who lives in the apartment one floor up. He invites me to see what's left. The first explosion hit just before 8 o'clock as he, his wife, and three daughters slept. He grabbed his children and moved them back just before the second blast laid waste to their bedrooms. Everyone is alive. He kisses his hands, then raises them upward in gratitude.
Alhamdulillah. Oh my God, thank you.
But with so many others dead and wounded, there's anger aimed at those he blames, other nations who he says support the opposition. This is their gift to us, he says. Is this democracy? Is this freedom? I don't think this is freedom. I think this is a conspiracy against my country. At a military hospital, the first casualties came in within minutes. This soldier, who doesn't want to give his name, lies in his hospital bed. His face and legs are pockmarked with shrapnel wounds. He says his back has deep bruises and his feet are wrapped in bandages. He was in the military building when the blasts hit. He made it out to the street and found a gruesome scene. There were cars that were burned out completely. There was fire all around us, he says. All the houses across the road were smashed. There were people buried under the rubble, including women and children. This is the latest and by far the worst in a series of bombings in Damascus in the last several weeks. Dr. Majid Hassan says it represents a new and alarming shift in what has already been a long and violent uprising.
It is sure that there is something wrong in the head.
Hassan is standing outside the room of another victim with a skull fracture and a brain hemorrhage, who he admits may not survive. Back at the scene of the bombings, the cleanup continues, as do the questions about just who was behind them. As much as people here blame terrorists supported by foreign interests, the opposition insists it's a government operation aimed at discrediting them. Whatever the truth, today's assault on one Damascus neighborhood drives the chances for peace back even further.
The World's Laura Lynch joins us now from Damascus. Laura, there seems to be some debate over who carried out this bombing. We heard a man in your story who blames this on a foreign conspiracy, and that's also the conclusion of President Assad's government today. What is the evidence, as far as you can tell, that supports that?
Well, that's the problem. There is little evidence of who was behind this, and so far there has been no claim of responsibility. Now, you've heard these words about foreign conspiracies before when other bombings have happened. There have been five of them this year, and that is a familiar refrain from the government and those who support the government. What you hear from the opposition groups, though, is a completely different suggestion, and that is that the government itself is behind these bombings, and it is an attempt to discredit the opposition. So there is a great divide here, and this deep distrust is growing ever deeper every day. Now, at the same time, I should say that there is a radical group that has emerged that has claimed responsibility for smaller bombings of government buildings. And there's also some suggestion that Sunni extremists from Iraq could have been involved here, but there simply is no clear evidence of that.
Why would extremists from Iraq want to bomb targets inside Syria?
This is only a theory, Marco. Being Sunni extremists, they are targeting a regime that they see as not favorable to Sunnis, the majority Sunnis in this country, the regime being populated largely by Alawites and Christians.
What was the apparent target?
The apparent target was a military complex called the Palestine Branch, and it is a counterterrorism operation there. It is well known for holding prisoners, interrogating them. There are reports that torture was used as an instrument of interrogation inside this building. So that's why there are suggestions that it was the target of the opposition. The opposition says that they wouldn't put it past the government to be targeting their own people in order to discredit the opposition.
Clearly, Laura, one of the big questions today's bombing in Damascus raises is how big a blow it could be for an already fragile peace process. Where does this leave the UN mission?
Well, I think that you could see how much the UN sees this as a serious blow by the very fact that as soon as this happened today, the head of the UN mission here went down to the site and exclaimed his own disappointment at what had happened and urged again that this kind of violent action cease in the name of trying to build a peace in the country. It just becomes increasingly evident every day, Marco, that there is a huge challenge in trying to establish a ceasefire. I mean, there is supposed to be one in place, but it's being broken every single day. Still, the UN will tell you they know if they give up on this now, they are giving up on what they say is the last best chance for Syria to avoid a true civil war.
The World's Laura Lynch in Damascus, the Syrian capital. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
By the way, Laura sent us several dramatic photos from the site of the bombing in Damascus today. You can find them, plus more of her reporting from inside Syria, at theworld.org. One Arab nation that has escaped the convulsions of the Arab Spring is Algeria. In fact, today the North African country is holding parliamentary elections. Algeria's military-backed government describes them as the most open and transparent for decades. Dozens of new political parties are competing for seats in parliament, but most of the candidates are either linked to the ruling National Liberation Front or have close ties to the establishment. Financial Times correspondent Borzu Daragahi is in the capital, Algiers. Borzu, what's the mood today there? Are polling stations busy?
You know, actually, they're not busy at all. And even interestingly, at some of the showcase election centers, those election centers that are near the international hotels, the journalists and the TV people can easily get to, even those weren't very crowded at all. there's a lot of cynicism and apathy.
Yeah, where does that come from? What's that about?
I mean, the root of the problem, of course, was what happened in this country in 1991. There was an election after a period of political openness that was Algeria's version of the Arab Spring. Islamists, listeners may recall, won that election in the first round, at which point the ruling military elite canceled the elections, essentially staged the coup d'etat, and started rounding up people and throwing them into prison. What happened after that really devastated the country for the next decade. A civil war was ignited. And only now are Algerians starting to come out of the bloody haze of that conflict, where 200,000 people died. You know, so they're a little bit wary of the whole political class and what the political class has done to the country. And essentially, you know, you got to hand it to them. Their analysis is pretty good. The parliament doesn't have a lot of power constitutionally. It's the president who proposes laws even. And so, you know, I see their points. Like, why bother voting for a system that just perpetuates itself?
You know, coming out of that civil war in the 90s in Algeria, it wasn't like democracy bloomed overnight. And you say there's that perception of corruption. Why has there been no Arab Spring in Algeria?
They don't really want to go out into the streets again because it didn't really get them much last time. Also, you know, Algeria is not Egypt. Algeria has $180 billion, at least, in hard currency reserves. That doesn't even count their gold. Reserves. Algeria is oil and gas rich. It can afford to throw money at problems whenever there's a flare up, whenever there's a big protest over housing or something. The government responds to the best that it can, you know, building some new houses, buying off its critics, raising police salaries here. In contrast to, for example, Egypt, the police and the security forces are better paid, better trained, better uniformed, better behaved on the streets. So there are not some of the more systemic problems that you see in some of the Arab countries.
So what exactly is Algeria? Are Algerians expecting from this election today? Who's going to come out on top and what difference ultimately is it going to make?
You know, that is really the question. You have this sort of variety of political forces taking part in this election, from the pro-government socialists to the pro-government, you know, liberal capitalists to the Islamists. The question is what power this parliament will ultimately have. It's, you know, really not clear. None of the parties have nuts and bolts programs that I could discern, you know. And whenever you get into a discussion with the parties about what their program is, they start talking about like 1958 and the Party Congress of 1965. And I'm just like, you really are going to voters with this stuff? Do you really think that the young people who are jobless and in their 30s and 40s and still living with their parents because they can't afford their own place are going to be interested in these little debates that you're still having from 40 years ago? Instead of having a jobs program, how to build on the petrochemical industry to create decent jobs, how to build good housing stock, solving some of the country's transportation problems. There's no discussion like that among these lawmakers or would-be lawmakers.
I'm curious, Borzu, was this election, this parliamentary election, part of a political calendar that's been set for some time? Or did the Arab Spring awaken politicians in Algeria that some democratic adjustments needed to happen or else?
I think a parliamentary election was in the worst. The last parliamentary elections were in 2007. But definitely the way they build this election, the way they hyped it, the way the authorities hyped it, and they invited international observers here for the first time ever. You know, many journalists were invited and given visas. And the way they touted it was definitely a response to the Arab Spring. They knew they had to make some kind of change. So they went with this formula to give the international community, at least, the assurance that Algeria was trying to make some changes in response to the cataclysmic changes that are taking place in the region.
The Financial Times, Borzu Daragahi, speaking with us from Algiers. Thank you, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, presenting the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The stock exchange in Madrid, Spain, had an up day today. Investors liked the government's takeover of one of the country's biggest banks, but that's little comfort to those Spaniards who find themselves struggling to make ends meet. Unemployment is at almost 25% in Spain, and that's pushing more and more people there closer to poverty. Some have turned to scavenging for food, as the world's Jerry Haddon reports from Madrid.
On a bus at dawn on the southern edge of Madrid, a 62-year-old Romanian immigrant named Titi Tarintiac stares out the window. His little wheeled grocery carrier rests next to him in the aisle. His destination is Merca Madrid, Spain's largest wholesale food market. Restaurants and supermarket buyers come to this complex of long warehouses for everything from fish to tomatoes. On this morning, the loading bays overflow with food. Soon, so will the big green trash containers. That's what Tarintiac is waiting for.
Porque estoy en paro y como no estoy trabajando.
Because I'm unemployed, he says, and I can't find work. I need to find a way to survive. Tarintiac says he worked for Madrid's City Park Service for more than a decade as a gardener, until 3 months ago when public spending cuts hit.
Ya no tiene dinero los ayuntamientos para pagar para.
The local government no longer had money to pay for people like me, he says. I have a family, a wife and two daughters who live with me. Our apartment costs about $800 a month, plus utilities. It's early and the garbage containers at Merca Madrid are not yet full, so Tarintiac wanders off between the 18-wheel trucks, examining melons and tomatoes that have fallen off pallets. Groups who work with the poor in Spain say food scavenging is becoming more and more common, as are visits to soup kitchens and other charities. Gabriela Jorquera is with the Madrid Network in the fight against poverty. She says as Spain's crisis enters its third year now, welfare payments for many people are running out. She says the crisis cuts across society.
Son personas cada vez más jóvenes, familias.
She says we're seeing younger and younger people falling into poverty. Single-parent families and immigrants have been especially hard hit by the crisis. Jorquera says the number of Spain's working poor is growing at an alarming rate. She says over the last 2 years, 2 million more people have entered this at-risk category, bringing the total to over 12 million.
El resultado de las políticas de austeridad y las medidas contra el déficit.
She says Spain's budget slashing, designed to reduce the national deficit, is the wrong way to go. Instead, she says the government should boost welfare payments, invest in job training and education. But Spain is in the midst of a major banking crisis brought on by a collapse in the housing market. This week, the government announced its fourth bank rescue package in 3 years, this time to the tune of up to $30 billion. That, combined with financial markets demanding austerity across the eurozone, leaves the Spanish government with little maneuvering room. And it leaves Spaniards who still have jobs worried as the country re-enters recession. Plácido Gascón works in a Barcelona construction supply warehouse, loading bricks and sacks of mortar. He says his job is safe for now, but his two grown children, both with law degrees, haven't been so lucky.
Hombre, claro, tengo los hijos, mira, tengo mi hija que ha hecho la carrera de derecho.
The two of them are living at home with me, he says. I used to think at this age, with their schooling finished, my kids would have flown the nest, but these days it's impossible. Bunking up with family is one way to save money, but immigrant Titi Tarintiac doesn't have that option. His extended family is in Romania. As the morning marches on at the Madrid food market, he says what he'd really like to do is retire, collect his pension, and go back to his country. But he says he needs to work a few more years to qualify. But who's going to hire a guy who's 62 years old, he says? What company would want me? At my age, it's difficult. No one is going to hire me just so that I can reach retirement and quit. Tarintiac turns to wheel his small grocery carrier, overflowing now with produce, back to the bus stop for the trip home. One must trust in the future, he says as he leaves, that it will bring us something better. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid.
We remain in Spain for today's GeoQuiz. The Madrid Open tennis tournament is underway in our mystery destination today. It's a relatively new sports facility with a roof that slides off almost magically. But what's really spectacular about it is the court. It's blue, blue clay, Smurf blue. In a moment, we'll find out what it is and why it's there. But first, can you name the magical place where the Madrid Open is happening? Before you can say 15 love, here with the answer is freelance sports photographer Quique del Olmo. Where is the Madrid Open taking place, Quique?
Well, isn't the Caja Mágica, the famous for somebody, the Caja Mágica, the magic box?
You know, for world-class tennis, it strikes me that this has got to be a big break in tradition. You've got green for grass, and you've got red for clay. Why change a red clay court to a blue clay court?
I imagine the only reason is marketing. I mean, it's commercial reasons.
What? Why marketing?
Because it's different from the rest of the tennis courts.
I see.
So the sponsors are being very happy because everybody's looking at this court.
Right. And I gather, coincidentally, the color of the main corporate sponsor of the Madrid Open happens to be blue.
Yeah, I can't tell, you know, if they have something to do with that. But it's a very good point.
Some people are saying that the blue court actually helps with color saturation. You can see the ball more easily. You're a photographer, Kike. Is it helping you?
Well, I can tell you, for us, it's great. It's fantastic. You can see the ball better. The contrast is fantastic. And it's good. On top, you have something different. You know, if you're shooting tennis in different places, well, that's a new thing. So you're always going to have a new image. For us, fantastic. But I think the most important people in this game is the tennis players. So
how are the tennis players finding this court?
They are not happy. They are not happy, and there's very different reasons. One of the reasons is because they are so used to play every day in very special conditions that when you change that, well, it's going to bother them. I mean, these people play automatically. You know, the movements are so perfect that everything can bother them. And this is something they don't like. This color, they are not used to it, so they don't like it. But on top of that, of course, there is a reason. They don't run exactly as they run in the red surface.
I've heard Rafa Nadal hates it because it's too slippery, and Serena Williams loves it because she says you don't get as dirty on it.
Well, everybody has a reason.
Everybody has an opinion. Do you play tennis?
No, I don't. I just take the photos. Yeah, I don't. But I think there is a consensus about, you know, the opinion of the majority of the players is not good. But nobody really is listening. Money sponsors are more important.
Money is more important than what the players think.
Yeah.
Freelance sports photographer Kike Del Olmo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
By the way, Rafa Nadal must now really dislike the blue clay surface. He unexpectedly lost his match today, his first loss on clay in a year, and is out of the tournament. Nadal says he won't be back next year unless the surface is changed back to normal. You can see a video of how the Madrid Open makes its controversial blue clay tennis court at theworld.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead, remembering the last surreal hours before Libyan rebels took Tripoli last year.
It was like Armageddon about to happen, or we were awaiting a comet to hit the earth. And people, you know, they just silently waited.
Assessing the Libyan revolution, coming up on The World.
The World is supported by the Medtronic Foundation, presenting the Save a Life Simulator, an online experience designed to teach life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Fewer Mexicans are now migrating to the U.S. That's in part due to better economic opportunities in Mexico. But the economic outlook in Central America remains weak, and violence there is soaring. So migrants continue to head north from countries like Honduras and Guatemala. The journey is brutal. Kidnappings and abuse by drug gangs are common. Some migrants, though, are getting help as they pass through Mexico in shelters run by Catholic priests. Monica Campbell reports.
Adelante, señores, váyanse acomodando así detrás.
It's dinner time, and about 100 men sit at long tables waiting to eat.
Vamos a quitarnos las gorras, por favor, señores.
Father Pedro Pantoja runs a shelter in northern Mexico, ministering mostly to Central American migrants, travelers filled with tales of hope and fear, of grueling train rides, and a desire to reach the U.S. border. But tonight, they feel protected. A young Honduran man offers a prayer. He's thankful for the food and the safe haven. He and the others need it. The shelter sits about 200 miles south of Texas in the small city of Saltillo. The northbound trains run through here, and it's where the deadly Zetas drug gang often targets migrants. In 2010, cartel members robbed and massacred 72 migrants nearby. After grace, Father Pantoja speaks bluntly.
Esta casa es para ustedes los centroamericanos.
This house is for you, Central Americans, for the situation you face as you go through Mexico.
Pantoja is tall, 67, and wears jeans and boots when not donning his violet priest habit. More than 50,000 migrants have passed through Pantoja's shelter since it opened a decade ago. These shelters are now fortresses on Mexico's most violent front lines. And Catholic leaders like Pantoja consider it their duty to God to build more of these refuges. They're not wrestling with policy debates or the question of whether these shelters actually facilitate migration. Sister Maria Guadalupe Arguello, who also works at the shelter, says it's not her job to tell people whether or not they should go to the U.S.
We never tell them to stay or go, but we will let them know how difficult the situation is and what might happen.
So far, the church runs more than 60 shelters in Mexico. Most are near train tracks. That's the freight train nicknamed La Bestia, or The Beast. The name comes from the dangers that migrants face trying to catch the train for the journey north. Even if they make it aboard, which isn't a given, they're often shaken down by gangs, robbed at gunpoint, or held until their relatives in the U.S. pay ransom, ranging from $1,000 to $3,000, often paid through wire services like Western Union, a business found in most Mexican towns.
Este es el dormitorio de... Los hombres.
Pantoja shows me the dormitory for men. It has capacity for 80 people. There are also female-only rooms, but no women are here. Reports show that 6 out of every 10 Central American women migrating through Mexico are raped. For those who do make it here, there's a range of services, including crisis counseling. Pantoja Shelter is now considered a model in Mexico. Pantoja listens to Jaime. He's 19, from Honduras, and hopes to earn more in the U.S. than the few dollars a day he makes picking coffee back home, when he can even find that work. Jaime's journey has been, in his words, hell. Jaime's coyote, or human smuggler, turned out to be part of a kidnapping ring. Jaime was held captive with other migrants.
It was a house filled with all the ugly things that have happened to migrants. A newspaper showed young women and men who'd been beheaded.
The criminals told Jaime, that's what happens to migrants like you, whose families don't pay up. Despite what he's been through, Jaime wants to try again. Father Pantoja offered advice.
Be sure to get there during the day. You can't arrive at the border at night. It's very dangerous.
Jaime then huddles over a map of the U.S.-Mexico border with other migrants. The migrants swap intel. Cartel hideouts, the safest places to cross. With Jaime is Bryant, 24, also Honduran. He left home because...
It's too hard living over there. The food is too expensive. The job is not good. That's why I want to go to the United States, because the United States is good for you. If you work hard and save your money, you can make something in your country.
Brian appreciates the companionship at the shelter.
Sometimes you feel so alone because you don't have your mother and your brothers. You don't have nobody right here, only God.
It's getting late now. Pantoja makes the rounds and checks her room with closed-circuit cameras showing the streets beyond the shelter's high concrete walls. Migrants have been kidnapped just outside the shelter's gate.
Vivimos en una situación permanente.
We live in a permanent state of risk and threats.
Although Pantoja is reluctant to talk about it, drug cartels also target him for harboring migrants. He essentially deprives the cartels of targets and revenue.
I've received threats by phone, insults, but also that one day I'll end up dead.
Just as the migrants' trek is perilous, so it seems is running a shelter to protect them. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell in Saltillo, Mexico.
You can see what the migrant shelters in northern Mexico are like at theworld.org. This time last year, Libya was in the grip of a bloody civil war. Muammar Gaddafi was fighting to preserve his regime after 42 years in power. The rebels trying to topple him were struggling to fight past his defenses on their way to the capital, Tripoli. The city eventually fell last August. The BBC's Rana Jawad was the only Western reporter to remain in Tripoli throughout the civil war. She also knew Gaddafi's Libya very well, having lived several years in the Libyan capital. Her new book is called Tripoli Witness, the remarkable firsthand account of life through the insurgency. She joins us from Tripoli. Rana, you're British-Lebanese, married a Libyan. When you first arrived in Tripoli some 8 years ago, what were your impressions of Gaddafi's Libya?
Well, it was quite intimidating. I think that's an understatement. I was 22 at the time, a fresh graduate from university and just trying to make my way through the world of journalism. It was my first posting. So it was uncharted territory, not just for me, but for a lot of Western journalists at the time. It was a very difficult country to get into as a reporter and to report from as well. It was incredibly repressive. It was very difficult to get people, normal Libyans, to talk to you. So you almost felt on a daily basis that you were trying to find your way through a minefield constantly, especially when you were working a story.
Then last year, the Arab Spring came and the revolt in Benghazi. You didn't leave Libya. Tell us what you did do, Rana, and how life changed in Libya for you.
Well, I did stay in the country, specifically in Tripoli. I couldn't leave at the time simply because we didn't know how things were going to develop. And I was one of two foreign correspondents based here. So a large part of me felt I had a duty to remain, not least of which also because I've been here for 8 years. And other things complicated matters for me on a personal level because I'd recently gotten married to a Libyan who was also from Benghazi, which was where the uprising started. In the first 10 days, in the first weeks, I was reporting openly to a certain extent, but then I basically had to stop. I went off broadcast and eventually I moved on to writing for BBC Online under an alias name of Tripoli Witness.
Why did you stop broadcasting?
Well, the night I went off the air was on the night of the protests here in Tripoli. And although I remember very clearly and vividly, you know, broadcasting off the rooftop when bullets were flying around and people were being shot at as they took to the streets here in the capital. At the time, these were normal civilians protesting against what was happening in Benghazi. And Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi's son, who is now in prison at the moment in the country awaiting trial, he came on air on state television and made a very damning and I think for many a memorable speech because not many people are likely to forget that anytime soon. But the undertone of that speech was very threatening, not just to the people, but also to the foreign media. And I remember he named a couple of foreign media in that process. That was the time when editors basically made the decision back in London that I need to get off the air. And that's when I stopped.
So how was that moment last August when Gaddafi was driven out of Tripoli? It was the most complex military operation of the war, and it was a total surprise. What was it like to be in the middle of it?
As the weeks went by, a lot of people started giving up almost in Tripoli, saying it doesn't seem like anything's going to happen in the capital. Of course, when the weeks turned into months, hopes all but disappeared as far as Libyans were concerned. And we did know when the rebels had entered Zawiya, which is just about 35 kilometers away from the capital. We knew, you know, it's about to hit home, which was Tripoli. And we heard about it 2 days in advance. But then again, there'd been false alarms in the past. And we just, at the time, we weren't sure. But then there was this aura all around and this incredibly, I don't know how to describe it. It was a very surreal moment, but it's like, it was like Armageddon about to happen somehow. Mm. And we were awaiting a comet to hit the earth. And people, you know, they just silently waited. I remember for 48 hours before the rebels entered, people were just waiting and they knew. And then when the mosque started calling out, God is great, God is great, which was everyone's cue, the Libyan cue for people to take to the streets because the rebels had arrived, it was explosive. I mean, a lot of people, not to my knowledge at the time, I didn't know, but a lot of people in the area had all armed themselves by then as the months went by in Tripoli. That's what people were doing. They were right. collecting arms, whether it was Kalashnikovs or RPGs or anti-aircraft artillery. And suddenly all these weapons came out. And people were firing into the air in celebration, mostly, even though they came out to protect their areas, to prevent any of Gaddafi's forces from coming in, because there was a very real fear up until Tripoli fell that it would be a bloodbath in the capital. So people were very fearful of what would happen. But then they were surprised that, you know, it fell within 3 days, though there were some isolated battles around the capital. It was a relatively easy process for them.
And later, as we now know, Gaddafi was captured and killed in his hometown of Sirte. A new Libya is being built now. How's it going?
I think it's a difficult time for a lot of people here, although the optimism is still there. I think it's best to quote an official I met with just a couple of days ago who said, you know, between any revolution and state, there's a period of chaos. And that's where we're at right now. And there is that recognition, whether it's on the official side or by people, that Libya is still in a state of some form of turmoil. There's still some sporadic clashes. You know, they're trying to move ahead. There are a lot of changes here. I'd been away for the last 4 months in London. I partly needed a break from Libya after 8 years and the war. I've just recently come back. And coming back, I see the difference. You know, I left a few months after the fall of Tripoli. And 4 months on, a lot of new things have developed. I remember getting into the car just 10 days ago when I got back and turning on the radio and listening to English programs. That never existed because under Gaddafi's rule, English was not allowed in the country. They weren't allowed to put up signs in English on shops, and they weren't allowed to broadcast anything in English on the radio. For someone who's, you know, been based here for such a long time, you know, you cannot help but sit back and kind of smile and say, you know, good for them. They're trying to move on despite all the difficulties that still exist. So although the country is facing difficulties, it's not on the brink of collapse.
Rana Jawad, BBC reporter in Libya and author of Tripoli Witness, the remarkable firsthand account of life through the insurgency. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Just ahead, if you lived in Mexico, you better have flowers and song for your mom today. It's Mother's Day there on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from PBS and Masterpiece, presenting the new season of Sherlock, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman as crime fighting's favorite team. The game is on Sunday, May 13th at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A political cartoonist in Iran has been sentenced to 25 lashes, yes, a whipping, for drawing a member of the Iranian parliament wearing a soccer jersey. The case is hardly the first involving an Iranian cartoonist being punished by the country's authorities, but it is especially disturbing. The World's Carol Hills covers how political cartoons influence, reflect, and in this case, make news, and she's been following the story. Carol, what was the cartoon about?
The cartoon was about the efforts of this member of parliament from central Iran to get a major soccer team from Tehran to relocate to his city, which is a much smaller city in central Iran. So the cartoon shows him in a soccer jersey with his foot on a soccer ball.
And why did the MP sue?
No one really knows. People have only been able to read the official accounting in the Iranian news agency. The understanding is that he's just offended and doesn't want to be depicted in a cartoon. But boy, has it caused a stir.
Yeah, why has it caused a stir?
Well, the member of parliament sued the magazine where the cartoon appeared. The case was tried before a jury. The magazine got a light punishment, but the cartoonist was sentenced to 25 lashes. What's so weird about this case is I've been speaking to Iranian cartoonists today, those outside of Iran, and they're baffled because they say this is a really tame cartoon. There's nothing new about cartoonists being persecuted in Iran, but they look at this cartoon and they just don't get it.
What about the government? Has any official reason been given for what's so offensive about this cartoon?
The only thing that could be a problem, one Iranian cartoonist said, the member of parliament in the cartoon, a dark mark is shown on his forehead. And some Muslim men will get a dark mark after years of praying, of doing the daily prayers.
They put the forehead on the ground.
Right. But that wasn't brought up. And what's really disturbing is that this is the first time a cartoonist has been persecuted for a non-religious cartoon.
Mm.
And that's what everybody's so worried about, because it sets the threshold much lower for getting into trouble with the authorities.
So what's happened to the cartoonist in question? And, I mean, does he have any colleagues in Iran coming to his aid?
Well, he is at home. He's not in prison. His name, by the way, is Mahmoud Shokreyeh. And how it works is that when it's time for you to receive your whipping, you are called to court and taken into a room and whipped. No one knows whether the lashings will take place. The other aspect of this is a local case. This is a local judge, a local court, and national authorities in Iran have not responded. But boy, there's been a huge response online by Iranians inside and outside Iran, drawing cartoons in solidarity with this cartoonist and lots of overseas cartoonists. So there's a lot of activity online, and it seems as if the Iranian cartoonists inside Iran are trying to alert the national authorities and try to force a response, even though it puts themselves at risk.
The World's Carol Hill's on the case of the Iranian cartoonist sentenced to a flogging. Carol's got a slideshow of the offending cartoon and the cartoons that have been drawn in response to it. That's all at theworld.org. Carol, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, as I'm sure you know, Mother's Day is coming up here in the U.S. But in Mexico, Mother's Day is today. And tonight, countless Mexican musicians will take to the streets to serenade their mothers with boleros. It's the kind of music reporter Beto Arcos knows well.
I grew up in Jalapa, Mexico, listening to boleros. Every night, my father used to tune in to his favorite radio show, Trios Famosos, in the late 1960s. Of course, back then, I could care less about this music.
En tus manos está nuestra dicha.
It was only in my late teens when I began to appreciate the meaning and the practical purpose of boleros. This one is called Decídete, Make Up Your Mind.
Decídete a decir sí o no, a entregarme tu amor o llenarme de pena. El infierno es mejor a esta cruel situación de incertidumbre. De una vez, por favor, sea por bien o por mal, decídete.
The lyrics say, make up your mind, say yes or no, surrender your love or fill me with sorrow. Hell is better than this current situation of uncertainty. Once and for all, for better or for worse, make up your mind.
De una vez, por favor, sea por bien o por mal, decídete, decídete, decídete.
Songs like this would prove useful in my late teens when I learned to play the guitar. Every couple of months, I'd get together with a few friends and we'd pick songs to sing to our girlfriends in the wee hours by their bedroom windows. Believe me, there are songs for every emotion, and we knew most of them. From Sugary Love to Heartache to Splitsville, there are boleros for all matters of the heart. Here's one called Locura, Madness.
Todo ha sido un sueño, tú a mí me engañaste, yo no fui tu dueño. Solo tu fragancia, como cruel martirio, me trae la distancia. Cuando por las noches...
The lyrics say, everything has been a dream. You deceived me. I was not your owner. Only your perfume, like a cruel martyrdom, brings me the distance. When I dream of you at night, I live that moment of ours. I want to remember it as a diadem of my misfortune, because to go looking for it, to revive it, is madness.
Pues ir a buscarlo para reanudarlo es una locura.
Ah, those adolescent years. Among the most popular boleros are those made famous by Mexico's trio Los Panchos, the group credited with popularizing the genre. The trio Los Tres Reyes has a new album that pays tribute to the legacy of Los Panchos with a few of the boleros from their vast repertoire. This one's called Contigo, With You.
Tus besos se llegaron a recrear aquí en mi boca, llenando de ilusión y de pasión mi vida loca. Las horas más felices de mi amor fueron contigo. Por eso es que mi alma siempre extraña el dulce alivio.
This is the kind of bolero you'd sing in a serenade to your beloved. It could also be a good song to play on this 10 de Mayo, Mother's Day in Mexico. Just make sure you remember who you're serenading. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
If you want to be serenaded by Los Tres Reyes, and clearly you don't have to be a mother, then head over to theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can.
PRI, Public Radio International.